Hi, Teresa.
I'll be reading from the back of the devotional this morning, Romans 8, verses 18 through 30, from the Holman Christian Standard. Creation. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is going to be revealed to us. For the creation eagerly waits with anticipation for God's sons to be revealed. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in the hope that the creation itself will also be set free from the bondage of corruption into the glorious freedom of God's children. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together with labor pains until now. Our bodies. And not only that, but we ourselves who have the Spirit as the first fruits, we also groan within ourselves eagerly, waiting for adoption, the redemption of our bodies. Now in this hope we were saved. Yet hope that is seen is not hope, because who hopes for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we eagerly wait for it with patience. Our prayers. In the same way, the Spirit also joins to help in our weakness, because we do not know what to pray for as we should, but the Spirit himself intercedes for us with unspoken groanings. And he who searches the hearts knows the Spirit's mindset, because he intercedes for the saints according to the will of God. Our life's story. We know that all things work together for the good of those who love God, those who are called according to his purpose. For those he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, so that he would be the firstborn among many brothers. And those he predestined, he also called. And those he called, he also justified. And those he justified, he also glorified. May God bless that reading of his word.
Can this be true? Can we serve a God like this? I heard a lot of groaning this morning from your prayer request. Groaning. Liz's song and Tad's song, exquisitely appropriate. You know, I think one of the lines was, when the light breaks in upon the night. Because if our faith doesn't have real world practicality here and now, then it is, like Lennon said, it's opium for the masses. But can it have an impact on our lives today? And let me tell you something about this Roman passage. 18 through 30, there's so much here, and I feel a certain amount of trepidation, and I have been waiting so long, years, to be able to share this with you. It's a privilege for me to talk about these passages, because the Holy Spirit has explained these passages to me, and I feel a certain amount of trepidation that I'm going to mess it up. So I have to let go of that, right? I have to let go of my worry about results and just share what the Spirit has shared with me. Tim Davis is Romans 8, 18 to 30. You don't need to know the particulars. But you do need to know, this is experiential for me when I talk about this. We talked about Ecclesiastes by way of review. 2 weeks ago, we read the first chapter of Ecclesiastes, and that was by Solomon. And I know that sometimes you might look at people with a certain grain of envy. Do you? They've got it all. Nothing bad ever seems to happen. Their family's intact. Their marriage is great. Their kids are healthy. They got plenty of money. You know, being transparent, Teresa and I have that grain of envy. And it can be an issue sometimes. We have that grain of envy about intact families. And our family is very much intact. I don't mean to say that it isn't. But always, always, when we celebrate anything, there is that great sadness behind us that is there. It's a tinge of sadness always. And we look at families that have not experienced that sort of thing with envy. And then I look at Solomon, who had it all, and still he's depressed. He's in despair. And he asks the question, he doesn't ask the question, he makes a statement. He says, what is crooked cannot be straightened, can't be. And what is lacking can never come around again. And the despair that he felt, and I think we feel, and that Romans dispels, is, boy, if that's the case, then we are, like Thoreau said, by Walden Pond there, and he said, most people live lives of quiet desperation. And I think that's the despair, isn't it? And that's the groaning. Because if what is crooked can't be straightened, and if what is lacking is never coming around again, then we've got a problem. And it does tend to make us go to despair. Now, you've got things in your life that are crooked and lacking. And Solomon he's groaning about it. And what makes him miserable and tired, and it's a violent mental activity, is he has to understand why this is true. He says, I applied my mind to seek and explore through wisdom all that is done under heaven. And he says, God has given people this miserable task to keep them occupied. It is a miserable task. The misery of having to know and the tyranny that exerts over you. And what jumped out at me when I read these Roman passages, if you got that on the back of your devotional, I'm going to encourage you to make notes on this, because this can be absolutely life-changing for you. I'm telling you, it can change your life. The power of not having to know. There is such power in that concept that we don't have to know. This prayer request Kathy made, and I asked, do you understand it? Do you have to? Because if you do, you're like Solomon. It's a miserable task. And you go down that rabbit hole, and you never find the end. And I have people that I know, acquaintances, relatives, that are in that rabbit hole. And they're not going to stop their mental tantrum until they understand why thus and so has happened to them in their life. They're miserable to be around. They influence no one for the kingdom. They are stuck in this, like these hamster wheels. They're stuck on this wheel. Because they demand to know. And it's a miserable task, and they're miserable. And then I read, when I was reading this, and this is marinated over years, as I said, over years. It took me years to understand this passage. And what jumped out at me and what Paul says here is there's such a power in not having to know. There is such freedom in not having to know. So Solomon's groaning about this. So I began to give myself over to despair, Solomon says. Depression, anxiety, futility. Then he comes to the conclusion and he starts to have another groaning. It's okay to groan, by the way. It's okay to groan. But there's a difference between groaning in despair and groaning in hope. And at the end of this first, the second chapter of Ecclesiastes, again, I would invite you to soak yourself in that if you like to do Bible study. Soak yourself in that because you see at the end of the second chapter, Solomon groans with a despair that is, though, not despair, he groans with hope. He groans with hope. You've all predestined your lives. I did too. You've all predestined your marriages, your children, your occupation. This is how it must work out. This is my plan. I predestined it. This is what's going to happen. What if it doesn't? It didn't for me. But I no longer put a demand on God that he explained to me. And the freedom that comes with that, and the power that comes with that. So here we have Romans 8:18 following. And you know, I see how I did that with the paragraphs. Thank you, Nathan. I actually did it, but I see how I divide. You see what's going on here? Creation has a groaning. So here's what I did. By creation, I put plight. Each paragraph starts with the plight of the different entities. Okay, so creation has a plight at the beginning. And at the end of the paragraph, there at verse 22, I wrote hope. Creation starts with a plight and it ends with a hope. That's an immutable process, by the way. You know, you'd like to short-circuit that and get right to the hope. Don't think that's biblical. Our bodies. Plight. Write plight there. Right by that word. Our bodies. Plight. And then at the end of verse 25, our bodies. Hope. We move from plight to hope with our bodies. Creation moves from plight to hope. Our bodies then move from plight to hope. Our prayers. Your prayers answered? Your words fly up, your thoughts remain below. Words without thoughts never to heaven go. Shakespeare? Feel that way? Our prayers plight at the beginning, at the end. The hope. And there's a tremendous hope with that praying, that paragraph. Tremendous. And then finally, here's the biggie. Our life's story. The plight of your story. My story. And at the end, the hope of our story. Does that sound interesting? Does this sound interesting? Does this sound like really a powerful manifestation of how God can affect our lives? Is this something that you could use? I refer to this a lot. Because either we serve a God that intervenes from the heavenly realm into our earthly existence and does notice and does care and does change our trajectory. Either we do serve that or we serve a deist. Yeah, thank you. A deist. Thank you, Dan. A deist, you know what that is? A deist is a detached God way up away from us who just watches us with benign curiosity. And just, again, Shakespeare, okay, forgive me for that, but they come to my head, so I'm going to, he says, like flies, we are like flies to wanton boys, we are to God. He kills us for his sport. Well, that's pretty hopeless, isn't it? You know, and I had to come to grips with a God who still allows the groaning, but then takes the groaning in ways I could never have imagined and turns it. I didn't have peace till I let go of that, till I grasped that. Didn't have peace. And like I said, you're stuck there. Many people are stuck there. And here, let's... Can it be true that we serve a God like that? Do you have a visceral understanding of that? And do you have a visceral belief in a God like that? Let's get into this. Verse 18. We're just going to go through this very slowly. It's going to take us a few weeks. No, really, Tim? A few weeks? Yeah, a few weeks. What else do you have to do? I mean, we're going to get through this, and you're going to really be blessed. But we're going to go through it slowly because the Spirit wants to speak to each category here so that you understand. And Paul starts out in Romans 18 there, verse 18, chapter 8. Hey, can you say this? Can you say that verse? For I consider, Paul says, I reckon. Paul has come to a conclusion. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time, all that we suffer in this present time, all that we suffer. Teresa's big phrase from Richard Rohr, I believe, is it all things belong? All things in your life belong. Take any of those things away, and you're less than. Paul says, he's figured this out, he's thought about it, he has an experience, and he says he comes to this conclusion. Here's the conclusion that he comes to, and then for the rest of these paragraphs, he argues this point. He makes his point. He proves what he just said, because I need that to be proved to me. Do you? I'm just not going to take that. Because I need evidence that, yes, the crooked can be straight, and what is lacking can be counted toward me, Paul, because give me some hope here. Because creation has a plight, and Paul's going to say not only that, but our bodies, our prayers, our stories. And here's what he says. Sufferings of this present time are the crooked and the lacking, and everything that we suffer in this present time, look what he says, are not worth are nothing in comparison. Now there's the key. We do not minimize suffering. I've had plenty of it. But the only way it becomes not worth anything is when it's compared to something else. Right? It's why there's good and evil. Good means nothing if there's no evil. See that? It's meaningless. Our sufferings are meaningless, not meaningless, are worth nothing only when they're compared to something. They're nothing. All that we suffer in this present time, that is a tremendous statement, is nothing in comparison with something. Oh, wait, not so fast. Our suffering is worth something, as we will find out. It's worth something. It has value. But it's worth nothing in comparison with what? And here's the glory that is going, not maybe, is going to be revealed. And here's the sticking point to us. Now, who's that? I'm not a universalist. to us is a specific subset of people. Maybe you want to circle that. To us, who is it? Who gets in on this great deal? Paul is apparently aware of some hidden force or some hidden system that is operating in God's creation, in his good creation. Paul's aware of something behind the scenes that he can make a statement like that. And then he's also aware of there's something glorious coming. There's something glorious that is destined to be revealed to us, to the us. Well, we're going to ferret that out. We're going to find out exactly who that is. And if I'm in that group, and if you're in that group, because if this opening statement by Paul is true, if verse 18 is true, it would make sense that we would do any and all things to be in that group, right? We would want to be the us, because wow, what Paul just said. Okay, Paul, prove it. Okay, I'll prove it. Verse 19. Here's why I know that's true, Paul says. Because creation itself is eagerly waits with anticipation for the same event. What event? For this glory. Well, what's the glory? What are you talking about, Paul? Well, he describes it right there. God's sons to be revealed. I want to make sure you understand what I just said. Who doesn't? Of course, no one's going to raise your hand, right? That would be... The glory that is destined to be revealed to us. Watch this. Vital important, or you'll miss this whole thing that Paul does. The glory that is destined to be revealed to us, he defines in verse 19. The glory he alludes to in verse 18, this is how Paul writes, is defined in verse 19. So what is it? What's the glory that was destined to be revealed to us? What is it?
God's Son to be revealed.
Yes. Thank you, Teresa. The glory that's going to be revealed, that is destined to be revealed to you, that makes all the sufferings that you have now worth nothing in comparison to that glory, is sons and daughters of God are going to be revealed. Well, that must be something that's going to be revealed to us, and importantly, write this in, for us. It's destined to be revealed to us, but also for us. And it's so glorious that all we suffer pales into insignificance in comparison to this. And it's so glorious, the revelation of who you are, the revelation of what it means to be a son and daughter of God, that even the created order itself, rocks and trees and streams and that field, the sun, the moon, the stars, even the created order itself is waiting with eager anticipation for this event to occur. Why? Why do they care? Why does the created order care or want God's sons and daughters to be revealed? What's in it for them? What do they have a dog in the hunt? Creation, I'm personifying it, and I'm going to be able to do that because Paul does it. I'm going to personify creation. Creation has a dog in the hunt, apparently, because something's in it for them. Something's in it for creation, for God's sons and daughters to be revealed, and apparently it's going to be glorious. Okay, Paul, the way he writes, he answers that question in verse 20. Why? Well, because here's the hidden system Paul's aware of. And here's what we need to go back to our mandate that was given to us by God and given to you every single day in Genesis. Well, the reason, Paul says in verse 20, the reason the creation is waiting with eager anticipation for God's sons and daughters to be revealed, for God's sons and daughters, in other words, to get their act together by the Spirit and to become image bearers, like they're supposed to be. And they wait for that with eager anticipation because creation was subjected to futility. Not willingly. No, they went kicking and screaming. Creation put its feet and its hands against the door jams and was drugged kicking and screaming through the door into futility. But they didn't go willingly. But because. Why were they subjected to futility? But because of him who subjected it. Somebody subjected creation to futility. In the hope. Whoever did this, and that who is God, God subjected the created order to futility with an intention. In the hope. I'm going to subject creation to futility, God says, because I have an intention here. I have a plan here. And creation's being subjected to futility is part of that plan. And creation goes begrudgingly into this futile situation. In the hope, Paul says God did this with the intention that the creation itself will also be set free from the bondage of corruption into the glorious freedom of God's children. Wow, there's a lot there, and I think I'm confusing this. And I'm struggling with this right now. I think I'm confusing this, so I'm going to just... Creation is waiting with eager anticipation for God's sons and daughters to get their act together. Because creation is subjected to our competence as image bearers. You ever have a bad boss? A bad manager? You're subjected to futility in your job because you're under the incompetence of a manager. Okay? Is this making sense now? And you might go kicking and screaming into that futility. But that's the order of things. They're my boss. I'm under them. I'm subject to them. And because they're so incompetent, the trickle down in my life is that I'm subjected to futility. Because I know that they're incompetent. And I know that they're just going to stay incompetent. Therefore, I have this... I'd like it to be better, and you know what? Even I'm eagerly anticipating that they will somehow, some way, develop into a better manager. That's creation. Now, I think that makes sense now. I think that's it. I think that works. That's creation in us. Creation was subjected to our competence as managers. Where? Where did that occur? Genesis 1:26. I've made a world, now you look after it, my humanoids, and here's the tool. You just reflect my image into that created order. And if you do that, creation will go humming along and everything will be great. Use my image. You will be competent image bearers and creation will then flourish under your management. But God... We are incompetent image bearers, aren't we? And instead then of creation being glorious, creation we find is crooked and lacking because our image bearing is crooked and lacking. Well, we find out that was God's intention. God did that. He intentionally did that. He intentionally put creation under the auspice of incompetent managers. But he did it with an intention. He did it on purpose. He did it for a reason. What's the reason? God has a hope. God has a hope. I'm the CEO of this corporation, and I've installed this manager, and I put everybody that works for him under, they're subjected to his competence, and I'm the CEO, and I'm going to keep him as a manager because he's my brother-in-law, so I really can't fire him. So the CEO then would have a hope, wouldn't he? The CEO would, I hope, by subjecting these other people to his competence, that the manager will develop himself, will become better, will become the manager I always knew he could be. See, that's my hope. And the way I'm going to motivate him to do that, my intention for subjecting all the plight of all of these employees to his competence, my intention is that that will wake him up. You see this? That he'll see the futility of his employees, the ones under him, he'll see that and he'll be moved to better himself. So that's my intention. I'm going to do that intentionally. Because if his management is crooked and lacking, he's going to see that, and he's going to see it by the plight of his employees. We're going to look out at the created order, God says, as his managers, and understand, what do you think? Crooked and lacking out there? Well, we have to put the onus right back on us, don't we? Because now we understand, well, yeah, things are crooked and lacking in the world because our image bearing is crooked and lacking. You see? The hierarchy has been disturbed. And God, I got to motivate. I've got to get them to see the consequences, in other words, of their crooked and lacking image bearing. How do I do that? Futility. How do you do it with Solomon? He made Solomon come to a point in his life where he looked at everything as futile. And that's what motivated Solomon. Any futility in your life? Do you see any futility in the world? The world's stewing in its own juices. They deserve to go to hell. Well, no. God says, no, not so fast. Let's go back and read Genesis 1 again. Because the way of the world is dependent on the way of my image bearers. And you have become incompetent image bearers. And therefore, everything underneath you is subject to futility because it's dependent on you. Bondage of corruption. That describes our image bearing, doesn't it? That describes our lives. You got any bondage of corruption? And do you see the opposite of the bondage of corruption? Look how Paul writes. Bondage of corruption, then what does he say? From that into what? From that into glorious freedom. How's that sound? Well, that sounds good to me. Glorious freedom. And what jumped out at me, that's a description of what it means to be an image bearer. And we talked about that. If you have a life of quiet desperation, if you're like Solomon, if you go to bed at night and you're in despair, or if you just don't see a lot of meaning to life, that's bondage of corruption. If you want your Christian experience to be thrilling, It's fraught with problems. It's fraught with like I described to you this week, you know, the good angel, bad angel thing on our shoulders. You know, I know that's not biblical, but it's fraught with problems to get into the fray of kingdom work. It is. But on the other hand, it makes what Paul says at the beginning there eminently true of your life. Your sufferings, everything you suffer, and I mean everything you suffer, becomes nothing in comparison to being used by God. Try it on. And it becomes gloriously freeing. You get over yourself. Well, that's so important. Get over yourselves. That's what futility does. That's what futility can drive us to. You get off your stuff. And to be an image bearer then, and I know this sounds good to you, gloriously free. Instead of being under the bondage of corruption, I now become gloriously free. That sounds so good to me. The glorious freedom of what? Now here, remember I said we didn't know who the us was in verse 18, tracking with me? Remember I said that? You circle to us. Here's what I do. Teresa says, I can't read your Bible. There's circles and arrows all over the place. And there are. It's like a maze, actually one of those mazes. Circle to us, then circle God's children. Now you know who us is. Draw an arrow from the to us to God's children. That's who gets in on this deal, that your sufferings are nothing in compared to the glorious freedom that's coming. God's children. That's the us, God's children. Well, okay, but we still don't know what constitutes being a child of God. That's coming. But now Paul writes like a rosebud. A rosebud. He makes a statement, and the rosebud's very tight. And then he goes through his argument, and the rose slowly opens up. That's all Paul writes. He's slowly opening the rose here. So now you know, God's children are the us. Verse 22, we'll end with this. For we know. Well, here's something we know. Remember I said the power of not knowing? Paul toggles back and forth in this argument between what we know and what we don't know. What we know and what we don't know. But here's what we do know, and I think we do know this. That the whole creation has been groaning together. Aren't they groaning? Is creation groaning? But here's the hope. Here's the hope. Creation started out in this paragraph groaning in despair and futility, didn't it? See this? Groaning over its plight. You have a plight. And you're groaning over that plight. And the groaning is groaning of despair and futility. Creation's doing it too. Creation is groaning with despair and futility at the beginning of this paragraph. And here at the end of the paragraph, look at the groaning. The groaning has morphed. The groaning has changed into what? Labor pains. Okay, what's the difference? What's the difference between groaning with despair, you tell me, and groaning with labor pains? What's the difference?
There's a beautiful ending.
Excellent, Kat. Perfect. There's an expectation of hope when you groan with labor pains versus the groaning of despair. And the game changer, what changes the groaning of despair into groaning of labor pains of hope is the Spirit. The Spirit. Creation itself can't groan. Something, therefore, must be animating and hovering and brooding over this creation and groaning for it. What would that be? What's that remind you of? Genesis 1:2. Doesn't it? This is beautiful. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was empty and void and formless. And the Spirit of God, I love this, hovered and brooded over that seemingly unrelated, seemingly unredeemable chaos. And the Spirit of God hovers and groans over that irredeemable, seemingly, chaos, seemingly, and groans to the Father. Here's the same thing. Same thing. The Spirit never let go. See this? The Spirit never let go. And the Spirit is now hovering still over creation and groaning, groaning to God. And it is that Spirit's groaning that changes from the plight of creation, from despair into hope of something new, hope of something glorious, hope of some of a new birth. Futility. The Spirit groans. And on the other side, as Kathy said, the hope of something glorious, the hope, the game changer, is that Spirit's groaning. Tracking? Understand? Romans 8:18-22 now? Got it? Because you're going to see this unfold, the rosebud unfold. And it's going to have tremendous implications for your lives. Let's pray. Thank you, Lord. I think you spoke today. I think the Spirit was hovering here today. Amen.